Alaskans, wherever you are, welcome to the Must Read Alaska Show, coming to you from somewhere in Alaska. This is the place where we talk about, you guessed it, Alaska, where we keep the mainstream media on their toes, and where we are standing up for what's right in a world run by leftists. You can find out more by heading over to mustreadalaska.com, and also checking out the Must Read Alaska YouTube channel for some really great content. But first, let's get this party started.
Welcome, everybody, to the Must Read Alaska Show. I'm your host, John Crick, coming to you live from somewhere in Alaska. I hope everybody's having a phenomenal day today. The sun is out on the Kenai Peninsula, so I am a happy camper. We just had an election in Anchorage last night. Looks like Suzanne LaFrance has won and will probably be the mayor, I think, July 1st. I want to thank everybody that listens, watches, reads Must Read Alaska. If you want to help keep the lights on, just go to mustreadalaska.com. On the right-hand side, there's a little donate button. Every $5, $100 helps keep the lights on here at Must Read Alaska. And if you want to sponsor the Must Read Alaska show, just email me, John J. Wichen, at mustreadalaska.com. We have a special guest today, president of the AFL-CIO, Joelle Hall. She's joining us for the second time. She was on a couple months ago, and I'm super excited that she's back here with us today. Welcome to the Must Read Alaska show.
Well, thank you, John. Appreciate being asked to be back.
Well, this will be fun. The last day of session, right? It's a crazy day today.
Nuts. Yes, wild.
So my first question to you is this, you know, we covered some of this last time you're on, but I think for a lot of folks, they'll get to hear from you for the first time on this podcast. They'll tune in. This will be out later today. So kind of take me back to why you got involved in the labor movement in the first place. Give me that story. Everybody's got a story on why they first got involved in what they're doing.
Well, I came to the labor movement through politics. I moved to Alaska after I got out of the Army to go to college. So I was in college and I was an intern, you know, the University of Alaska has an internship program where you can go and serve in the legislature, not serve like a lawmaker. I shouldn't have said it that way. Work in the legislature. I did not serve. I worked. So I was working for then minority leader Fran Ulmer. She was in 1993. And so I was working in the building and I really enjoyed it. It was kind of, you know, eye-opening in a really good way, how a small group of people and us and people who cared a lot could make a really big difference in the outcome of things. It was inspiring to me, actually. So I came back and started just working in politics, and then I kind of moved into public policy of all different types. But in 2006, I was asked by the then president of the AFL-CIO, Jim Sampson, who some of your viewers may know from a different era. He was the former commissioner of labor, former Alaska regent. He wasn't a regent, but he was on the permanent fund board. So he asked me to kind of help work on labor stuff, and that was it. I was hooked. So nice. I'm working on 20 years now. So I'm here. This is the most fun thing. I can't imagine doing anything else.
So how, like, do you ever feel the pressure? Because, you know, whether you like it or not, you have one of the most influential jobs in Alaska, arguably, you know, some would say the most influential job in Alaska, as you have thousands of people that are kind of underneath the AFL-CIO. How does that pressure treat you? It's a big responsibility.
Well, of course, you always want to make sure that you're living up to the trust reposed in you by the people who've elected you. In my particular case, I'm an elected person, right? I serve a 4-year term. I'm elected by the delegates from all of Alaska's unions that are inside the AFL-CIO, which is over 50 unions. And yeah, you want to be faithful to the trust. And so the thing about politics and about public policy is things take a long time. And that's good and bad, right? It's good because sometimes change is hard and you need lots of voices and you need to be really respectful of how you move a piece of public policy through a process. And it's also frustrating because things take forever. So that's the good and the good side, bad side of doing this kind of work is that you have to have a lot of patience. And, I am a very patient person, and I also have, I don't know, I, you will lose more than you will win in any given situation, right? That's true in trying to move public policy. That is true probably in elections, but you just got to keep plugging away. And I don't know whether that is like some kind of tick in my brain or, you know, that part is like, well, that's just the way it is. And I just will try again. So just get up and keep going and keep trying again, because I really believe in the issues that we put forward, and I really believe in the values we stand for. And so it's been my experience that a lot of people have an idea about what we're all about, but they may not have actually ever talked to anybody from inside the labor movement. They might actually not know how we do what we do. How does one organize a union? What does a union do for them? What are the rules and limitations of a union? And I also want to make sure that the people listening, the AFL-CIO is not a union. We're a federation of unions. So we are to unions what the Chamber of Commerce is to business. So, you know, I represent people from all different types of walks of life, you know, from grocery store workers to public employees, nurses, electricians. And it takes a long time to earn the trust of that many different types of people, as well as to kind of like understand their issues. I will never say I fully understand their issues, right? But you have a base level of understanding that allows you then when situations dictate to go into acquire more specific knowledge to work on a particular challenge or problem. And that kind of education, it just takes a long time to acquire it. So I'm very grateful to be able to serve in this job, and I truly enjoy it.
So my guess is you have people that are Republicans, Democrats, liberals, conservatives, independents, libertarians, everybody under the sun.
100%.
So how is that? Because I feel like it would be a little chaotic at times trying to, just get all those people conjoined to one idea or even a couple ideas. Is it tough to do that sometimes?
Well, actually, it's easier than you think. What's hard is people's perception of how that works, right? The perception is that we are an exclusive club and only Democrats need apply. And that is completely false. And the reason why is because the values we represent, which is working people banding together for the purposes of negotiation, for their wages and benefits and working conditions, that is not a partisan value. Lots of Republicans and lots of libertarians share those values as well. And at the end of every day, that's what we're all about: wages, benefits, and working conditions, and electing people who support them. Those people come in all different flavors: Democrats, Republicans, and independents. So if you are somebody who shares those values, the people have the right to collectively bargain for their wages and benefits and working conditions. That's it. That is the litmus test, right?
So one of the tools that a union can use, I'm sure there's many, is a walkout or a strike or something similar like that. You know, we've seen Alaska Airlines. I'm probably going to botch the terminology and the time frame, yeah, but you know, trying to get a contract that they are excited about. Talk to me a little bit about that, because I think, you know, as Alaskans, we go to the Ted Stevens Airport, and we, you know, sometimes there's folks walking around talking about the Alaska Airlines negotiations. I think they got like a red lapel on, and it's in the news every once in a while. What are your thoughts on that? And kind of explain a little bit about that if you can, because how it works.
So airlines are regulated under the National Railway Act. So if you've ever worked at a factory or you've ever worked in a public employment, the rules that govern those workers are completely different than the rules that would have governed you if you were in a job before where you would have had the right to strike. So the National Railway Act has a very protracted process where, in order for workers to take advantage of their right to strike, there's all of this due diligence that must be met. So where we sit right now is there's a federal mediator that is on this job. And so the union, they've been mediating for quite a while on and negotiating this contract. If the union votes, they can vote that they can authorize a strike vote. There's lots of steps here, right? So they've authorized a strike vote. They have not authorized a strike. The federal mediators control the pace of all of this. And then when the federal mediators, they go to them and they said, okay, you are now authorized to engage in your strike vote. There's also a mandatory 30-day cooling off period. So there's all of these tools in the toolkit to try to drive them to a bargain before a strike happens. And those things are for both management and labor, of course, because nobody wants the level of disruption that these types of strikes bring. So they need to be released by the Federal Mediation Board to go into that strike. So we're a long ways from that. They've authorized themselves to vote on it, but they have not been released by the Federal Mediation Board to have that. Recently, members of Congress, 178 members of Congress, wrote a letter to the industries urging them to come to the table and bargain better with flight attendants. So this is a nationwide issue. It becomes so, like in Alaska, we feel it, of course, because we're so connected to air flight. And so many of us know people who work for Alaska Airlines or other airlines. So that's the process. We've been on many they're calling educational picket, because there's the language we use is really important. It's not a picket line, like in terms of like a boycotting picket line that you can't cross it. There's different levels of that type of activity. And so these are just informational pickets, informational actions. And so we've been engaging in those at the Alaska Airlines. With Alaska Airlines flight attendants at the Ted Stevens International Airport. And they've been going on all over the country as well, not just in Alaska. This is a nationwide.
So this process could take years. It's already been like, what, a year or so?
Yeah, this process is very slow.
Could it take years longer?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's very slow. There's lots of controls in this system.
Do you think is it on its way to potentially being resolved, or is that just kind of like, who knows, flip of a coin kind of thing?
I actually don't have any insider information about that, but I would imagine that the disruption of them actually voting to go on strike and entering the 30-day cooling off period that would be a massive step. So I would assume everybody's motivated to bargain. And that they're probably bargaining really hard right now. I hope that's true. And I think we have another action slated up in later on in May at the airport. All of these things just elevate the issue so that people like you understand that that little red Care Bear on their lapel is because those guys are in a bargain, right? Those guys are bargaining right now.
Yeah, I want to encourage folks. I've seen it maybe once or twice at the Ted Stevens Airport, and I think maybe in Denver or something as well. But, go talk to the folks, because at least at the Ted Stevens Airport, they were walking around wanting to talk to people. And so if you have questions, just go talk to the folks that are wearing those red lapel things. And, always remember, don't be a jerk. I try to tell people, be kind, even if you don't agree with somebody, you'll right. The conversation will last a lot longer. So
what I say to them, I support them in their bargain. But what I say things is like, I think they should get paid while boarding people onto an aircraft. I don't know. That's crazy. They're being told to show up at work hours before they start getting paid, and they don't start getting paid till the doors close. So every suitcase they lift, every little old lady they bring down the aisle, they're not getting paid for those hours. That just seems patently unfair to me. So that just seems really basic. You should get paid when you're doing your job. I don't think that makes me a radical. I just think that's pretty rational. Most people think those people are getting paid when they are boarding you, the most miserable part of the whole experience. They're not even getting paid for it.
Yeah, you know, it's like I always think about, you know, some a lot of the times the flight attendants are also babysitters to people that are drunk and just being ridiculous. So they have to put up a lot with some crazy things. And I have friends that are flight attendants, and you know, the thing that I would say is they don't make a lot of money.
Oh,
And
not at all.
it's, you know, it's just not well compensated, in my opinion. So I think when you look at some of that stuff, I think it's, you know, it's hopefully they'll meet in the middle somewhere, but these flight attendants are not becoming millionaires with their flight attendant salaries. So
They are certainly are not. That is a very good point. They're asking
let's
for
talk.
really basic things like getting paid while they're working.
Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about teachers, because I think that's a hot topic item for some reason. I think, you know, Democrats and Republicans, or conservatives or liberals, or however you want to put it, they oftentimes, most often, are finding themselves arguing over these points when it comes to teacher retention and recruitment. They most of the time don't see eye to eye. They don't listen to each other's point of views. All they do is basically tell the other person they're wrong. So, I'd love to hear from you on your thoughts on teacher retention and recruitment, because I think it'll be a perspective that maybe Must Read Alaska listeners haven't listened to or heard from on the show yet.
Well, I think I'll start off by being entirely predictable, which is we believe, when I moved to Alaska in 1990, Alaska had the most highly compensated teachers in the country, and we were really proud of that. Like really proud of it. We had great benefits, we had great wages, and we had people waiting in line to teach in our schools. So a lot's happened in the intervening 30 years in terms of the whole industry of teaching, in terms of the difficulty of it, more requirements constantly being piled on teachers, less, and then the slow degradation of their wages and benefits package. So in 2006, Alaska's teachers are not in Social Security. And as my dad actually was a public school teacher, he taught in California. And in addition to not being in Social Security, he didn't pay into it, right? So he didn't get it. But when my mom died, they also took her Social Security from him because he was a public employee, because he was a
Oh,
teacher.
geez.
So, they live in this weird space where they're penalized for being a teacher because they don't want to be perceived as double dipping, meaning like I think we all expect that when our partner, our husband, our wife dies, that we know we get the larger of the two social securities to continue to live on. Not if you're a teacher. They're going to penalize you. They're going to penalize your dead partner social security because you taught for a lifetime. So there's this all of these little, they're not little, they're major problems with the way teachers are compensated in this country. That's a countrywide problem. Now, in Alaska, that is true. And now also, we don't have a defined benefit pension for teachers. So, I think teaching, firefighting, policing, these are jobs that often you say you want to do this, you want to do this for your life. It's not something you're like, I know what I'm going to do. I'm going to go be a teacher for 5 years and then I'm going to go do something else. Like, I just don't think there are very many people who look at firefighting or policing or teaching as like the first initial job they get and then they're going to go do something else, right? I think most people enter these careers thinking they will serve, they will work a lifetime in these industries. That's what they're doing it for. So we with without a return without a defined benefit pension, we are losing young teachers to other school districts because they want to be teachers. And Alaska is simply not competitive. Public employees exist in a marketplace. And that's the thing that I think it's really hard for people to kind of comprehend. Public employees exist in a marketplace. It's a nationwide marketplace of firefighters, cops, teachers. If we don't provide the benefits, they will go to a jurisdiction that does. And we're seeing it. We've been seeing it for 20 years. We have about, I think Senator Geisel said yesterday, it's $12 million a month leaving with the worker because at 5 years, an Alaska teacher, if they work for 5 years, they can walk out of the state with all of the money they put in their 401k and all the money the state put in. They can just walk out the door with 5 years experience, a nice little nest egg, go to any city USA and get a job with a pension. Because we're the only city of our size in this country that doesn't have a pension system. Alaska, I'm thinking about Anchorage specifically. So we are not competitive in the marketplace for teachers, in the national marketplace, not even close to competitive. Now they all kind of have the same Social Security problem, right? That's a national penalty that is imposed on them. But we used to try to be the top of the market. And now we are clearly the bottom of the barrel. We're the worst place in this country to teach. So we will suffer until we remedy of this a little bit. Like there has to be some modification so that we're at least somewhat competitive with other states because this is a public place exists in a marketplace, and we are not competing in that marketplace.
So I think I appreciate your thoughts on that. I think the thing that conservatives would say is probably, I think it's hard for them to even hear that because, and I'm not speaking for myself, I'm just saying for other folks that listen in, because they'll say, well, we're last, we're dead last, or second to last, or third to last in test scores and whatnot. Do you correlate the lack of ability to recruit and retain good teachers directly affecting, those kinds of test scores in classrooms?
I don't think it helps. I think we all know any of us that had, I mean, my kids just graduated from high school not long ago, right? And I have had the experience of having a teacher who'd been teaching for 30 years and a teacher who'd been teaching for 2 years. I know the difference between those two classrooms. It's just, one teacher has got control of the classroom, one teacher has figured it out, one teacher's got it dialed in, the other teacher is struggling. We've all seen this, right? So if your whole system is predicated on teachers that are basically a mill of under 5 year teachers over and over and over again, you can't tell me that it doesn't have an effect. And so we're on this vicious circle of they want to see the improvements in the outcomes without improving the inputs. And I don't know any system that works that way. We have to improve the inputs. Kids are kids. Kids are kids are kids. So and I, this feels like that whole thing, like, the beatings will continue till morale improves. Like, I feel like we're having that argument, like, well, let's try something different. We've been trying this for 20 years. It's not working. We used to be pretty happy with our schools. Well, this isn't working either. We've got to do something different. And we are looking at outputs. And we are not having an honest conversation about inputs. And that seems unfair to the teachers, to the parents, and to the kids.
Well, I really appreciate your thoughts. Let's switch gears here and talk a little bit about the there's lots of apprenticeship programs, and I think that this is a cool opportunity for folks. I think trades is a really great choice of a career in Alaska. I think a lot of these trades somebody could go into out of high school, and if they're working on the slope, you could make 100 grand the first year, and that is something that is common to happen. You all have a bunch of apprenticeship programs kind of listed on your website. We don't need to go into specifics, but kind of in general, talk to me a little bit about some of these opportunities for apprenticeship programs as it relates to unions that are kind of in your fold.
Well, I tell you, our apprenticeships are busy little beavers because there is lots and lots and lots of work out there. Our apprenticeship systems, I think the thing that's important to understand about union apprenticeship, and I'm not talking about non-union apprenticeship, there is such a thing, right? But that's not who I work for. I don't know much about their systems because it's not my job. But a union apprenticeship is a training system that is owned by the union and the contractors. So it's really important for folks to understand this is not a public enterprise. This is a private enterprise designed to train a group of workers for a specific set of contractors who are paying the bills, right? They're paying for this training. So you have, you know, Jim, John, and Joe's Construction band together to train laborers because they use laborers all the time. So they work with their union, and Jim, John, and Joe's Construction pay to train. And Jim will say, I need 14 laborers. And Joe says, I need 12. And Bob says, I need 14. That's how many we put into the apprenticeship system. It's a supply and demand proposition, 100%. However many workers that our contractors need is how many we train. So if you are interested in becoming an apprentice in a union skill or craft, then the best thing to do is to go onto one of the websites. You can either go to the AGC's website called We Build Alaska, the AFL-CIO links to that. They're called JATCs, which is a Joint Apprenticeship Training Committee, because it's joint between the union and the employers. And then you can apply. Every single apprenticeship has a different entry standard. And the reason being, every apprenticeship has a different length and requirement. The longest apprenticeship is plumbing. It's 10,000 hours.
Electrician. A lot of hours.
Clean water in, poopy water out. Turns out it's kind of important. Yeah. So then electricians are 8,000 hours. And then you kind of go down from there. And if you want to be a sign holder, it's not that long, obviously. If you're a laborer, it's a much shorter time. All of our apprenticeship systems have a schoolhouse apprentice model. So you go to school, usually in the wintertime. You learn your trade or craft, and then you become an apprentice and you go out into the field, and you have the federal standard is 1-to-1, one apprentice to one journey person. That journey person is going to basically OJT you for 5 or 6 months. Then you go back and have more academic learning. And it's the academic part we think is really important. And I'm thinking specifically about something as complicated as electrical. If you only ever learned to do it the way Bob taught you because you were OJTing with Bob, what if Bob actually doesn't understand it, right? So you are only learning the way Bob did it, and you don't have any theory about why this thing works the way it does. So the really complicated, we call them skilled trades and crafts. Skilled trades are plumbers and electricians for the most part. They have licenses, they have national certificates of fitness. They are highly regulated by the state of Alaska, and because it's obviously very, very deadly to deal with live electricity and unsafe water. But if somebody's interested in joining these apprenticeships, you should absolutely go to these websites. And you are exactly right, John. This is what's really important for folks to, especially any parents who are listening who think that their kids might want to do this. There is no charge to be an apprentice. It is a free education into a job where you will quickly be making six figures. And if you are a plumber, that's the beginning. Like, that is the beginning. That is a very lucrative career, as well as being an electrician. Of course, inside electrician is also linemen, you know, the people who climb the poles, who deal with, like, those guys tend to be really adventurous types who like to, you know, be outdoors in the elements, climbing poles. It's a little dangerous. So if you're kind of a adrenaline junkie, a lineman might be a good job for you. But there's all different kinds of crafts, painters, cement masons. And then there's healthcare apprenticeships too. They're not in the AFL-CIO, but you should go onto the state of Alaska's website for apprenticeship, because if you want to get into the medical field, but you're not really interested in going to nursing school yet, there are new programs being offered all over the state of Alaska that will apprentice you into the entry-level healthcare professions, which often can be the bottom rung of a ladder inside of the medical system to get you education that maybe they help you pay for. So it isn't just construction that uses apprenticeship. There are lots of jobs can be apprenticed. People tend to think of it as the building trades, but the state of Alaska's website will show you all kinds of other apprenticeships if you're not into construction, but you do like the idea of being paid while you learn, that is what apprenticeship is all about.
Awesome. Well, we'll put the links in the podcast description for folks to go check out. Joelle, last question to you is this. Are you hopeful for Alaska? You get to work with folks all over the state, right? And hear from people that are out there building and fixing things. What are your thoughts on Alaska, its economy, and are you hopeful for us to maybe have some brighter days in front of us?
I am very hopeful for us. But I hope we can go back and look at what it took for us to get to this place, which was when I moved here in 1990, like I said, we invested in ourselves. We took care of ourselves. We invested in our people. We worked really hard to keep people in Alaska. We made choices that incentivized staying here. And I think we need to think about that again, because I think some of the choices we're making are incentivizing people to live elsewhere, and in particular, our kids. And my two kids are here, and I hope they're staying here. And I'm sure there's a lot of Alaska parents out there who want their kids to have jobs. Now, there's lots of good jobs out there. We're going to have more jobs than we have people for about the next 10 years. The question is, can we also innovate our way through that? This has always been our challenge. We have these gluts of opportunity that come our way, and we kind of ride around, and we don't lean into the next thing. And we have some chances ahead of us, like clean energy, cheap energy. Even if you are a poo-pooer about the clean energy, you should at least be excited about the cheap stuff. So we need to lean into cheap energy and figure out how to build our future, because we have to have our next economy is not going to be a petroleum-based economy. What's our next economy going to be based on? And we need to be thinking about that. And we need to have justice for petroleum workers, because you can't just throw these people who have been serving our state and their families out on their ears. We have to have a plan to transition and to build a new economy and find ways to keep our kids here. I'm very excited about it. I think we have a lot to offer. This is not, it's not a fun time, but we just have to have a collective will to invest in ourselves.
Well, Joelle Hall, president of the Alaska AFL-CIO, thanks for joining us. I appreciate you coming back on the show. We'll have you back on in a couple months. Do you have any last minute thoughts before we head off?
It's sunny. This is the first really nice day of the spring. I hope everybody gets outside, and I hope everyone has a wonderful summer.
Awesome. Well, thanks so much for joining us. For folks that listen, watch, read Must Read Alaska, if you want to help keep the lights on, just go to mustreadalaska.com. On the right-hand side, there's a little donate button. If you want to sponsor the Must Read Alaska show, just email me, John, J-O-H-N, at mustreadalaska.com. It is sunny. I hope everybody goes, has some fun in the sun. Until next time, I'm John Quick from somewhere in Alaska. Thanks, Joelle.